This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 312 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Shimmer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
So we're super excited again to share a really cool interview with you guys. Someone we've spoken with before. This seems to be like a kind of on repeat now, huh?
That's what we do.
A pattern for us. I mean, I speak to you all the time.
I mean, we like talking to new people too, but when you have a built-in angle, we want to keep bringing them back.
So we're so excited to be able to share our second interview with Miss Tara Bennett about the making of Outlander seasons 3 and 6. I Instagrammed and said 4 and 5. Then I corrected my dang self. And now I just said 3 and 6. Really? I mean, that's a bit much. 3 and 4. Yes. So without further ado, sit back, relax, grab a cocktail, maybe an Outlander themed cocktail or two, and enjoy. We hope you enjoy our interview with Miss Tara Bennett on the making of Outlander seasons 3 and 4. So we wanted to take the opportunity really quickly before we get started to say an extra special Outlander podcast welcome to Tara Bennett, who's joining us again. She joined us a number of years ago to talk about the making of Outlander, the series. I almost had chapters. Seasons 1 and 2.
Oh my God.
And this time,
wait, number of years? Has it really been that long?
It has.
Oh my gosh. It feels like it was yesterday. Obviously not yesterday, but more recently than years.
I mean, 2 years?
Three.
I mean,
am I wrong?
Three.
Okay, so now that I've thought about it, it did come out before our original pod abroad.
Oh, that was 2018.
Yeah, so it's got to have been at least...
It was more than that, too. It was 2 years because it was 2017, two years. I have to look and see. It's definitely two. It's at least two, just because it was the same time last year. I actually had like a Facebook memory of the cover of the other book from, I think, 2 years ago. I can't remember if it said it was 2 or 3 years ago.
Oh, well, to be fair, it was for seasons 1 and 2, and now you're covering 3 and 4, and they couldn't have finished 4 before last year, so that tracks for
me. Yeah, it's crazy. It's like a time warp.
Mm. Well, then you kind of have, or I mean, I know we're all here to talk about the same thing, but you said you got this Facebook memory of the cover of the first book. Speaking of memories and pictures and images, I have to ask you, whose decision was it, and did you have any say over the choice of the very first image, other than the cover, that the reader sees when they open this beautiful book?
I didn't. My wonderful editor sent it to me and said, "Do you think this is?" And I said, "That looks beautiful. That looks like an amazing way to start the book." I said, "They look gorgeous, and it's such a great kind of romantic, hopeful picture with them. You know, I mean, they look a little stern, and then the next one, then they look like, you know, super in love and smoochy." So I was like, "That's nice."
I love the cover, but once you open it, there's like the title page and everything. The first full color picture you see is Claire looking up to the print shop.
Yes. Isn't that beautiful?
And that is like, are you kidding me? That was like, I mean, I'm like, I'm going to get past this picture, I promise. But it was like, what a beautiful opener for this. Out of all the stuff you could have chosen or could have been chosen, what a beautiful, you know, because that moment, reviewing the book, and it kind of took us back as fans, right?
Because yeah.
The show's been, you know, not off, but season 3 finished a bit ago, season 4 finished a bit ago. And so reading about it was like, oh my gosh, like all the stuff that went into all the stuff that we saw and what we see is gorgeous and a whole product. And it's only the tip, like it's like an iceberg, right? You see this pointy, beautiful top. You don't see all the stuff. And that's the intent of what's going on underneath or what went went into that. And so all the stuff that you bring us and Matt and Tony, all the actors and everything, it's like, are you in so much? I mean, we said this with the first one. There's so much that goes on. It's like, dang, the fact that this gets made, it is a monster.
It is. It is a incredibly labor intensive show. And, you know, anybody that works on a TV show will say that, but this one in particular, because it, you know, if it's shooting in Scotland, which technically is its own ecosystem, they really didn't have much of a film production constant there until this show came. And then they basically took over an old warehousing system and created a studios that you would find, you know, like in LA or even Atlanta, which is really busy now, or if you were down in London. And so they basically have built and then kind of trained an infrastructure and reached out to all these places that have helped feed the period elements that they needed for the show. And so that's what this book covers now, 4 years. And then, you know, of course, they're almost finished producing five now. So 5 years really into the whole system. They have, you know, gotten more ambitious, you know, with what they've done. And I think one of the fun things about seasons 3 and 4, which ties into the print shop, is that there's a lot more subtle visual effects that have been woven into the show to kind of get the epic nature of it. And that's something that we felt like, hey, you know, it's a little like super nerdy and maybe not everybody's going to be, interested in it. But I think from even a casual viewer standpoint, there's the surprise factor of going, oh, I had no idea that they did that to be able to get that shot. And so whether it's the ships or whether it was how they burned the print shop and how they were able to kind of really create an entirely safe place for the actors where they're nowhere near a fire, but you would never know that. And what they had to do, because they, you know, technically shot that in one of the alcoves in Edinburgh, where you can't put a lick of flame near a building because it's historic and it's protected, and they don't, you know, they'll if you give it a bad look, you know, they'll throw you out. And so what they ended up having to do with creating a false facade and then superimposing and using green screen and all of that, you know, we just watch and go, wow, that was a really impressive fire, but it's fake. It's like, it's literally not in the frame that you think that you're looking at. And so, you know, circling it back to, there's just all these really cool elements to these two seasons in particular. When you look at a beautiful picture like that and you think of I, Malcolm in terms of the episode and then where it goes right after that, you kind of are just peeling back the onion layers, like you said, of, oh my gosh, there's just so much more story to the things that I just kind of took for granted. And hopefully that's, you know, fun, because like you said, we're on a Droughtlander right now. And so a nice way to go back and rewatch it is now with all of this information that gives you a new appreciation, hopefully, for even things that you didn't think were something to have to think about on a deeper level.
Well, to be fair, I feel like you could have done an entire book on print shops.
Yeah, I could have.
Myself, because that, I mean, that is such an iconic, I mean, it was an iconic part of the series before this existed. And it became such an iconic episode as well, because like we have this whole like back and forth with my sister where her favorite book is, what, 2? Because they rip everybody apart. And mine is 3, because they put everyone back together.
Yeah.
So she loves that they all get torn apart and it's melancholy and we all cry. And I love that, yay, they're back together and this is all I ever really wanted. So that's such an iconic episode and portion of this series that it literally could have been its own making of print shop.
It totally could. That's always the bummer of making, you know, I love having a book sit on a shelf, and that's, you know, makes me super proud, and I love having that. But the other element of it is it's never enough pages. And I know Outlander fans feel the same way, but you know, books and paper costs and printing costs and all of that quickly start making things really boring but also really expensive. And you know, we always put a lot of time into going, well, what feels like it's a reasonable cost for a fan? And while sure there are some people that would go, I'll spend $150 on a book, you know, there's a lot of people that go, are you nuts? I'm not spending more than 30. And so we have to constantly always think about, you know, what's the right price range? And it's always, you know, more consumer level. And so because of that, you know, we end up having like a page count, and that makes it unfun in terms of all the extra content I would love to have. I agree. There are several sections in the book where I feel like, man, I wish we even had to cut some things, you know, where I had some extra comments from either an actor or somebody that worked on the crew, and it would have, you know, it would have been nice to have it in the best case scenario, but you know, it just it's really the pain and the positive of having something in print.
And that's the larger like pain that you say is like, you know, you're going in, you're like, I can't give you all the things.
Yeah.
So how do I give you enough of all the things that you feel like you touched all the things without literally giving you all the things? And that was what was so like, it wasn't jarring, but because 4 was so recent for me in my brain, I was like, ew, we're going back to 3? What's happening?
It feels like a million years ago.
Even though I know on so many levels that we covered 1 and 2, so clearly the next space you would go is 3, but I was like, ugh, no one cares about that anymore. We've moved on. We're in the new world. Why are we back here?
It's true. It is. It was disconcerting to go back to 3 too, because I was in the throes of 4, you know, while I was writing this. And so my process is going back, rewatching episodes, then going back, rewatching scenes, and then making sure that if there's a reference to something, I look for the micro details or things to try to either prompt questions or to make sure that if someone's covered something that I'm remembering it the right way. And going back to 3 almost felt like going back to 1 and 2 in some ways, just because it's been so many years.
You've kind of hinted at this, but in your approach to this one about 3 and 4, did you have a similar approach to the way you approached the book for 1 and 2? And did you find that things that you learned helped you, or ways, things that you were able to improve to begin to tackle this one, whether it was, as you said, watching the episodes, looking out for things that maybe you made notes to yourself of, oh, you know, after the first one, you're like, I wish I would have done this or whatever. And then, or were there things that you left behind that didn't serve you as much as you thought they might, and or things that you brought on to help you, I don't know, be more efficient, find more stuff, look into more detail?
Yeah, you know, it's hard. I think the thing that always, when I conceived of the book, the first for seasons 1 and 2, it was always based in the question of, why would somebody buy this? And granted, you know, there's the answer immediately. I love Outlander. Why wouldn't I buy this? But it is an extraordinarily well-covered show by many, many outlets. You know, you've got, as highfalutin as Vanity Fair, as, you know, down to, just a really great Outlander blog that's, you know, covering it.
It's okay. You can say us.
No,
okay.
You guys too, inside and out. And so when you do that, you go, oh my gosh, you know, what can I give somebody that's worth them forking out money when they can go listen to a podcast or, you know, watch, you know, read something that's just posted, you know, weekly for the show or an interview or a postmortem. And so I'm always thinking, listen, my challenge in particular with this property, with this show, is I got to read what's been written. I have to see what's off tread ground. I have to make sure that if I see certain actors, you know, that were put on a press circle for, you know, maybe their episode, what were they asked and how did they answer over and over again? And how can I avoid them answering that in the same way so that this feels fresh, or it feels like I'm coming at perhaps a question that was asked by multiple people and was answered one way, if I can ask it in a way that they jog their memory in a slightly different way. So my research really comes from bookmarking the hell out of everything, you know, that happened for 3 as it was happening, and then 4, and then, you know, it's not a recap book, so I definitely, you know, get to stay away from the elements of just talking about story beats and everyone. But then I also do use that to an extent, because when I talk to the writers and the directors, who are the spine of every episode conversation, which is different than typical coverage, because they don't often make the director or the writer available to talk about the episodes. It's usually Meryl or Matt or Tony or an actor to talk about an episode postmortem wise. So then I can kind of go into the minutia of, okay, well, you know, maybe a recap. People seem to be really interested or question or want to know, why did this happen in an episode, from a scouring of looking at, you know, a different spectrum of recap coverage. And then, so then I can use that to go, all right, let me go ask the writer. Let me go ask the director, how did that scene turn out the way that it did? Because either it was really beloved, or people didn't quite understand the adaptation choices, or that it felt like, you know, something, as we always know, something completely different from the books. How did that come to exist, and what was the decision making? So all of those are the things that I really spend a lot of time preparing for before I do my interviews. And then I would say that the actual getting of the material is pretty much exactly the same. It's, you know, once I get the contract signed and everybody says, okay, we're going to just start getting the actors for you. It's really just a process then of, you know, some days I do 5 interviews in a day. I'd start it because obviously the show is in Scotland and I'm located in California. So there's an 8-hour difference. So I would start it sometimes 6 or 7 in the morning so that I'm working in their evening in Scotland. And I would just go until noon, 1 o'clock my time, just interview after interview after interview, because I'm catching them at their end of their work day, or I'm catching them when they're finishing a block so that I can get them before they're gone and moving on to the next thing. And it's just, I have to be so prepared because I don't know what's going to come at me. And with the coordinator for the show would just go, okay, you know, the night before you've got 4 interviews next tomorrow morning and they're each this long. And I actually had to say at one point, I need a pee break. So please just give me 20 minutes. And it was just, you know, it really became that kind of a process to not luxuriate in it. And I had to be really ready for it. And so, but once that intense period finished, then it was what I call the jigsaw puzzle of it all, which is placing elements of every interview where they belong. So do they belong in a feature interview where it's the actor talking about the character? Does it belong in the episode? Does it belong in a section where, you know, they're talking about production design and their voice is better there? And then once all of that is, you know, parceled out to where it belongs, then I start writing.
So I can help you feel better in the fact that Starz keeps all of their actors locked down. So the fact, so any access that you get to ask questions that fans are interested in, because God, I love Entertainment Weekly. I've been following them. I've been a subscriber loyally for years, like decades. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they have a very privileged position in entertainment.
Sure.
So they get access that all of the rest of us peons don't get.
Right.
So obviously you're not a peon, but we appreciate everything that you come at with a fan standpoint, because we have a lot of minutia questions.
Sure.
That like your Entertainment Weekly, you know, journalist isn't going
Let's
to ask
be honest.
Because they're not there.
Yeah. And a lot of, not everything, but a lot of things, whether it's Vanity Fair or Variety, whatever, even the big stuff, even though they want to capture, you know, big headlines and get Sam and Katrina and all these things, they want the bigger stories or the bigger things, like, you know, what's happening to the character this season, or who's going to the new world. They, with complete understanding from this fan, they're not looking, as Summer said, they're not looking at minutia. Mm-hmm. And just to be honest, sexy stuff sells.
Oh my God. It's always the, I have to, I'm proud of my book that there's no naked, how is it acting naked questions? I don't ask any of those because I feel like they're covered everywhere else. Exactly like you said.
Yep.
I promise you, Entertainment Weekly's first cover issue with Outlander had Katrina Balfe with like complete topless nudity with Sam Heughan's like arms and stuff covering her nipples. And I was like, okay, that's what we're doing.
It was cool. Like, it was like Austin Powers. It was like, oh wow, that elbow, definitely don't move it because we'll see way too much.
Exactly. So on the one hand, I get it. They're trying to be like, for the non-book readers, how do I get people to care?
Yes.
So I understand on that level, but you also have to understand, you also want the book readers to care. And we've been reading these books for 30 years now, right?
Almost 30 years. Yeah.
So, and we are full of minutia questions. That's all we have, because we've been thinking about all the big picture things for much longer than that. So we care more about the minutia and the character and why some choices were made.
Exactly.
Whatever and the choices may be.
I try to address that. I definitely look and see what are the controversy points from a standpoint of what the show intended and then how it was, processed by the fandom. And I'm always fascinated in the adaptation process because, like you guys, I'm a fan of Diana's books. I started, you know, my cousin got me a signed Voyager from when Diana was on her her book tour she found the books and was like, I just went to like be Dalton or Walden or whichever one it was. And I met Diana and I like had no idea who Diana was. And she just, we were both, my cousin and I, huge book readers. And so if we recommended something to each other, we knew each other's likes, and she said, because I found these Outlander books, I got to meet her at the, you know, at a signing. So I bought you the book, it's signed, a first edition. She goes, but you can't start here. So go to the library and get the first two. And so that's what I did. And so I really started, yeah, I started a third book, technically.
I feel like you almost had my experience, except for I discovered it myself in a grocery store with book four. So I read all of book four first. So I went in going, what? And then I had to go back and get all the rest of them. So luckily you knew when you got your signed copy of three that that was not the place to start. I had no idea.
Yeah. So I picked up the books around the third book and then went backwards. And so I've had just as long as thinking about, you know, oh, wait, you know, this doesn't match the narrative of what Diana read. And, you know, certainly there's been big digressions with characters that have remained alive and that, you know, are dead in the books. And so there's really a lot of pivot points that if you're a fan of the books, you're going, what? Hey, what's happening? And so I always like to lean into that and kind of keep those as my first, you know, questions to ask. So that the writers, especially, as I said, every episode is not a recap. It's a conversation with the two big creative voices on an episode, which is the writer of the signed writer and then the director of it. And those are the two people that are kind of really doing the first pass on what you're going to see in the final one. And then, you know, then it's obviously the Ron Moores, and then, as you know, season four has come in, the Matt Roberts, who are really kind of refining the edit, which is the last pass of storytelling on the show. But there's always, and I hear it from everybody, and even I have my own questions because I know the books really well, are, oh wait, that's a big digression, so why, tell me why. And that's something they've never shied away from, which I'm really happy about, and that can always be really a big part of these books, that you get your minutia answer about the choices and I did a signing with Diana recently and she has her questions about the choices as well. so you know, if she's questioning it and fans are questioning it, and sometimes people love it and sometimes, you know, Diana's not in love with it, but you know, the show is what the show is, and at least there's something where if you were to go, man, why did they do that, I kind of exist as the thing to kind of hopefully answer at least 80% of those questions somebody might have.
So totally non sequitur. Did you watch the New York Comic Con video?
I did. I actually, yes. And actually she was, you guys have to, anybody that's listening to this, the Poison Pen, which is in Scottsdale, which is kind of her local bookstore. They actually did live stream my conversation with her. And that it's a fun one. If you liked what she did in New York, you should totally watch that one too. Cause we,
I loved your tone just now.
She,
we will 100% find that link and add it to this posting. But it, like, just her, this is what I love about Diana. Like, she's so dry.
Yes.
And she's so honest.
Yes.
And she holds no punches. And they had that whole thing, what do you think about them keeping Duncan, not Duncan, I always call him, I get Duncan and Duncan.
I do.
There's a Duncan and a Duncan.
Yes.
And a Murta. So what do you think about Murta, them keeping him alive? And she's like, he should have died. I killed him.
Yes.
There's a reason I killed him. I don't know why you kept him alive. And everyone was like, ooh.
Yes.
Diana.
Yeah.
But then everyone's like, Diana, that's what she does. She's like, I wrote it a specific way. You should have followed my self-created, you know, formula. It was perfect. I don't know what you guys were thinking.
She's actually awesome because, you know, at the signing I just did with her, I just feel like, you know, I love observing her. The woman has navigated a fandom that she has created from scratch for 30 years. And, you know, she hears everything from the good, the bad, the like, are you kidding? You just said that to Diana? I've been able to observe it here and there for the last couple of years. And for me, it's just a masterclass on how to like gracefully and yet also be authentic to herself on how to answer, you know, anything that kind of comes at her. And, you know, there was a fan that was like, well, you know, I could hear in the conversation between New York and what you talked about tonight that you're obviously really frustrated with some things. And she just looked there, you know, and she, you know this, knowing her as well, that there's no artifice to her. She just says it how it is. And she just looked at the fan and she goes, I don't care, because my book is always going to be my book. And that's all that's exactly. important to me. And she goes, they'll make whatever show they want. And I'm just happy that it's remained as you know, the way that I still feel like it's still Outlander. But, you know, we're always going to, there'll be things that I don't agree with. But that's okay, because my book is my book. And that's the only thing I worry about. And when it's just like, yeah, you know, I mean, to have that kind of, she doesn't, this thing came in, you know, in the last couple of years, and she's been doing this, like you guys have said, for 3 decades. So why is a TV show going to make her in any kind of way question herself or imagine anything differently than she's been doing for the majority of the existence of this world? So it's just, it's really, it's admirable. And it's, I'm sure many a person, even myself, if I had created something as beloved and personal as this whole book series is, for her to be able to find a separating point is really cool. It's like, it's just fascinating to me and also admirable to me that she's able to kind of put them in places where she doesn't feel any kind of anything that she has to explain to herself or anybody else externally of herself about how she comes to regards with it.
And I would never claim to be the first person who said this out loud, but I know that I have echoed this sentiment since I heard it. And I don't remember where I heard it first, but the books are never going anywhere.
Yeah, that's it.
They exist. They exist forever. So if you get upset with the way the adaptation did something, go back to your book.
Yeah, that's it.
The book still exists. It changed nothing. And honestly, when they make such large shifty changes that are crazy, right? Like, as a book reader, you're like, what? Mm-hmm. You think about it, you're like, this allows me as a book reader and someone who's been loving these books for decades to be able to separate myself and be like, okay, I have to let this go. Clearly, they're no longer making my books.
Yeah.
100%. Right. And I can be on board with what they're doing.
But Summer, and that's the thing, is they were never making your book. That's
the thing. Yeah. And that's a big thing too that I try to explain in my books, is that when you change one medium to another, there are things that a novel, and especially that Diana does in her books, which is she can shift focus, you know, from Jamie and Claire to Brianna and Roger to young Ian to, you know, Lord John. And then, you know, so many more characters that are going to come, you know, from these books forward. And a book reader can shift that way and not feel as though there is any lack of focus on who the core of it is. But television is set up in a very specific model, which is you create a show around an anchor character, and that's the character in which everything, it's like the middle of the spoke of a wheel. And I teach a TV writing class, and you when you are with a show that loses an anchor, like The Office, where Michael Scott left, or, you know, if there's like a you know, Roseanne, who's left her show, there the show flounders because it doesn't know how to keep, it can kind of chug around like a broken wheel, but it's you watch and buy in because you're buying in for whoever that anchor character is and how all of the stakes and the goals revolve around them. And so Claire is the anchor character, with Jamie being a very close second, as almost like a one and two, with, you know, some rare shows like X-Files with Mulder and Scully have a one and two as the anchor characters that they work in parody. But even when one of those left, many people would complain and go like, it wasn't my show anymore, you know, because the dynamic was that the anchor, the spoke of the wheel right in the center, was those two characters, were the yin and yang. But in setting up the show and the perspective and the voiceover, especially in the first season, it's Claire, and that's not what the book is. You know, it's Diana has set it up differently, and so that's really jarring to some people that have read the books and feel like, why? No, you know, it's absolutely, the two of them aren't equal level. No, the television show has been set up that it's Claire, and that Jamie's a real close second. But it's only when we, you know, got his episode in the first season where his voiceover came in, and now, you know, they work in a progression where we can even have some episodes that are more about him as the show has moved along, so that they can kind of find that parody that's more book-like. But at the end of the day, you craft a show in a different way than you do a book. And that's inherently always going to feel really weird to people that have only lived in the book world and try to transition into what the TV show is doing. And that's, you know, I try to explain that a little bit through the writing of it, because that's why some people just go like, I don't get it. Like, why isn't, it feels like it's trying to put, you know, a circle and a square, and it just doesn't fit. And it's because it is just a medium change that's different, and how you set it up is antithetical to people that have been immersed in Diana's type of narrative for so long.
I would agree with that, but I would also moderately disagree mm-hmm. with that. And the reason I would disagree with that is because I think as book readers over the years, starting, I would say, with book two, as we got so horrifically wrenched out of Claire's dialogue right. and her inner monologue, we got wrenched into who are these people? What's happening? Mm-hmm. So as book readers, I feel like Diana prepared us for more characters.
Yes.
Because we were forced with book two to acknowledge Brianna,
yes.
to acknowledge Roger, to acknowledge those people. And those characters grew as the books did.
Yeah.
Whereas with the series, they still tried, and they tried really hard to make it Claire Jamie centric for as long as they could. Mm-hmm. And their attempts to get the television audience over to the side of the book reader who is expecting more Roger, more Brianna,
right?
Right.
Right.
I think that has been a much harder turnover,
yeah.
getting your strictly TV audience to get on board with it than your book reader.
Yeah, absolutely.
How many times did we read that people are like, why aren't we having more love scenes? Why aren't we having more Jamie yes. and Claire do, and, you know, like just them? And it's like, well, this is actually, whether they set it up that way or not, I agree with Summer in that respect, is that the show is – it'll never be the books, but
no.
they are, because who knows how long this show will last, you know, as a diehard fan, we're praying for all the books, but you never know. But just non-spoiler alert. And you know, this, if you guys have read this, and Tara can confirm,
yep.
and Summer too, that seriously, it only gets worse from here.
Yeah, it
meaning,
really does.
No.
We're at book eight, and book eight had eight main characters.
It starts getting Game of Thronesy with like all these different stories that, yeah.
Eight storylines, and each storyline yeah. can involve between one and three or four people.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the challenge, especially as the books get bigger and broader and the world gets so much more wider than a TV show necessarily does. I mean, TV shows that have ensembles, you know, even like going way back to like Lost, it was Jack was still the anchor character. And even though that show went way away from Jack at certain points and then finally came back to it. And, you know, some people got mad at the end of that show because it really was kind of closing out Jack's story. And you're like, well, wait, I didn't even watch the show for Jack. And you're like, but it's always been about Jack. Even though all these other stories happen, Outlander's going to the writers of this show are going to have to wrestle with that, because ultimately a tremendous amount of people that have come to Outlander just as television viewers and that are used to how things are presented to them are going to always kind of battle over like, wait, why isn't this just the Jamie and Claire story? And why are we not getting those moments that as a TV viewer that's been trained to watch around, you know, the anchor characters. No, wait, like there's going to be full episodes where it's just going to be Roger and Bree. And you know, if they could just be a Lord John thing, if you were to strictly go the way that the way the books go. And, you know, I think it's really interesting. And I have no inside information about this. I it's just my own personal speculation is that, you know, I would be very curious from just an observer standpoint to go, hey, how would like a Lord John movie go? Like if they decided to just say, hey, let's just try it and see would the audience that loves Outlander and, you know, maybe the TV people that have just only known the show, like many of people like my mom and other people that have only come to it through the TV show, would they watch a Lord John like mini movie? You know, would it like a 3-hour thing? Would they do that? Or is if it's not Jamie and Claire, then I'm out, you know? And television challenges more of that, and challenges because it's expensive to make a TV show or even a mini arc of a basically like a sidebar, you know, to the Outlander mythology. they have to feel like they're going to get their investment. And I'm curious if they'll ever make that, they'll pull that cord basically to say, let's give it a try. Because if it's successful, like, woo, there's all kinds of extra storytelling that you can do. But if it's not, you know, then that really cuts that off for and disappoints a huge part of the book reading fandom, you know. So I'm just curious to see where that'll go. But it's always, for me, fascinating about the process that they have to go through and what's accepted and what's rejected and what's, you know, brand new that the show just kind of pulls out of the ether to bring into their mythology of the show.
So I know that you were able to interview both Sophie Skelton and Richard Rankin mm-hmm. when they were peripheral.
Yes.
And given that they've moved into much more core four
yeah.
territory, how did you find the interview went down with them this time around? Did they have, I mean, they had a lot more as actors and characters.
They did. It was really nice because, you know, I think Sophie hasn't had an opportunity necessarily a lot to talk in his depth about the character. You know, they made her kind of press limited for her, especially in those very first episodes, because she was still getting used to it. And, you know, there wasn't a ton of narrative for her. And then, of course, in this book, for seasons 3 and 4, she's obviously a much bigger player. And I've always had a really nice relationship with her. And I think I've always thrown questions at her that she feels like, oh, good, I'm not just talking about how's it working with, you know, Katrina and, you know, how's it wearing, you know, itchy period clothes. I try to like kind of get into the meat of like, what has it taken for you to kind of, as a young actress, get thrown into this huge fandom, the expectations for it, and then you yourself, how do you want to play a character that goes through, especially in season 4, a really awful, awful, life-changing experience that is a story motivator and a life motivator for Brianna for the rest of, you know, the rest of the narrative that Diana makes in the show, you know, however long we get it, we'll follow through with. And she's always been really, really detailed. And, you know, I think we could have talked longer. She just had to get back to work. And so that was one of those things where I think if we had another 45 minutes, there would have been even more stuff we would have gotten into. Rick is great. And I was able with Sci-Fi Wire, when I was not working on the book, to do these kind of postmortems with him, video postmortems through the season for season 4, which was great. And so we have a nice friendship. And so he and I actually were able to just for the book interview, just do like we went to lunch and just did like an hour and a half just through 3 all the way through 4 to the very end. And so I'm grateful that they trust me enough to, you know, bother spending that much time and talking about the decisions that they've made and the backstory that they've been able to kind of really build in their head, and just as forthright and frank as they've been about the good and the bad and the things that they've learned and the things that they didn't anticipate. I think the first time I talked to Rick, he was just like a puppy, all excited, like, can't wait to get to all the things that are going to come. And then now he's really in the throes of it, and that was just really great to be able to kind of have more to talk about, because I think he was just so excited. It was the tip of the iceberg, as you said before, for the metaphor. And then now he's really got stuff to work with, and certainly she had really emotional stuff to work with, and trying to create space for that felt individual to Brianna was really important to her. So we and she was even disappointed, and she said, you know, I was bummed that the stuff that we had ever shot didn't end up getting used, because that's a really emotional thing to go through, and then to not have it used as you kind of expected it to be.
Yeah,
because the show made the
yeah.
choice. Yeah, and then the choice of the show was, hey, listen, this is an event, an assault that we have kind of trod this ground in other ways, all the way back to season 1. How do we do it without it feeling exploitive
and egregious?
So like, they made the call
to
do
it. Where it's like, how many more rapes are you going to have?
100%. And so they made the call to do off screen. And I thought it was chilling, but this still doesn't make it easy for an actor who like prepped to show it all. And then like, you know, it's not there. And so, you know, we talk about that, and the show has been really great about saying, hey, yeah, don't excise that, you know, we'll have that still in the interview. And that's great. And I never take it for granted their time because they're busy. And I never take for granted, you know, their ability to be as straight with me as possible. Because as you said, you know, they're kind of, a lot of times they're just given these little quick interviews to places like EW or other places where, you know, you get 15 minutes and for them to have time with me to be able to talk in depth and maybe say some things they didn't get to say in other instances, I think they appreciate that there'll be a venue for it. And then we just try to have an elevated conversation.
Well, one of the things that I loved and looked forward to, besides everything you were able to share about, well, everything, all the interviews you did and, you know, Matt's writing and reading about stuff from, about the set design and the costume, just like anything and everything in the book was like, you know, an Outlander fan's dream.
Oh, good.
One of the things I was really looking forward to and loved reading in both books is, especially since you have done the first one, now you're revisiting, if you will. Yes, you got to interview, you know, people again, but mm-hmm. also some of the new people, some of the new characters.
Yeah.
What was that like for you? And did you have a favorite? And was there something that you loved that you were able to do that couldn't make it into the book because of space? And was there someone that you really wanted to include, but you just, scheduling wise or whatever, it just didn't work out?
Yeah, I mean, that's always the hard thing. We gave equal spread space. You know, the first book, it was Jamie and Claire obviously had the most real estate in terms of the features with Katrina and Sam. And so because Roger and Brianna are really important, we gave them equal, because as you said, core four. So that eats up more page space. And so that, you know, kind of pulls back from being able to have some of the secondary characters or the recurring characters. So of course we would love to have had, you know, Jenny and Ian, but they actually were not available. And then you also have the balance of like, well, if we can get one, but we can't get the other. And then Ian, you know, we love him as an actor, but he wasn't in it as much, you know, as even the seasons one and two. And then, you know, I love the actress that Nell, who plays Leary, but I don't think the fans want to spend three pages on Leary.
I don't even want a paragraph.
And that's just a testament. It's a testament to Nell's work that everybody does not like, you know, her. And so you make the call to go, this is in no way a knock on Nell, but it's definitely like, I'm not going to give Leary space because I think the fans would like knock the book at my head because they would prefer
exactly.
someone else.
So I'm like, because that's the thing. If you did include her, we'd be like, wait, who did you knock off the list to include her? Because we would have rather
to include her. Exactly.
For sure.
Exactly. And then, you know, I had actually, the nice thing about when I didn't know if I was going to get the third and fourth book was that when I was doing interviews for season three, I was doing it for another outlet. So I had a word count when I talked to Tobias and to Katrina. And so I kind of held back some stuff just thinking, listen, Tobias is like hot property, you know, because, let me just hold this.
You can just put
case.
A period after that. He's just property. Hot property.
Exactly. Hot property. Dude, like, I agree with you. So it actually did work out that he had a personal thing that happened that didn't make him available for an interview. But I was like, aha, I already have stuff that I've held. So I get sneaky like that sometimes. So I was able to include him in an episode, not as a feature. But he really, you know, with the two appearances is Blackjack and then the one is Frank and the flashback didn't necessarily necessitate, you know, having a whole section for him again like we did in the first book. So, yeah, adding people like having young Ian. John Bell was just a dream to talk to, just the sweetest guy you'd ever want to chat with and so enthusiastic and so sweet. And then Maria Doyle Kennedy, who I was a fan of hers from The Commitments way back in the day. And then, of course, Orphan Black. So getting to talk to her was really wonderful. And, you know, Ed Spleers, who is just awesome, you know, playing a very different kind of villain in the show. And so we kind of went with the people that were big story motivators as much as we could, knowing that there are really wonderful people that are doing great character work, but just in a more supporting or you know, kind of role that just, you know, I wish we could have like pages and pages to add everybody, but you know, in instances where I could add, I'd put them in other sections. I'd, you know, do some quick interviews via email. So I just said, hey, listen, let's just focus on this one episode. And if you could just tell me some things that really made an impact to you as an actor, and then try to fold them in as those box outs that you see within the episodes. That was a way to try to at least get their voice in it. If they didn't necessarily have a carve out as a feature section, but it's always hard. And I always know that there's a disappointment for some people, and even some of the people that work on the show, some of the actors going, oh, bummer, I would have liked to have been in it. We always feel exactly the same way. We just, with what the show wants us to do, with what schedules allow to happen, and then just with our unmoving and, you know, vexing page count that just can't shift, you know, all of those things kind of make what you guys end up seeing in the table of contents.
So I feel like the last time we talked, we had mentioned, you know, do you think you're going to do this again? And it was a lot of, well, we need to wait and see if there's proof of concept. So I'm pretty positive we've had proof of concept. So
yay!
I mean, are we pretty confident that we're going to be moving forward with, you know, part three of the making of Outlander saga?
I hope so.
Is this your first trilogy, by the way? Sorry.
It would be my first trilogy, which would be super, super cool. I would love that. I would be beyond grateful to be able to do that. It's, you know, it's hard. Companion books are, they're an odd little niche, and it really depends on how people turn out for it. You know, I've been offered, you know, a lot of books, and as a freelancer, you always want to say yes, because you think you should, but then I am at a place in my career now where I can go, I don't know if that needs a companion book, so no, I'll pass that along to someone else. and Outlander always feels, I think that just anecdotally and looking at the market between the first book and certainly now that we're season five, the thing that you hope for, that you never know if it's quite going to happen, which is the addition of fans. And the thing that's been really lovely to see, because I think my first book is in a third printing, which is amazing. So that is one just, you know, across the board, awesome to get more than one printing on something like this, is that that means that the fans, you know, who didn't watch from season one, but maybe found it when it went to Amazon, or then now have found it that it's been on Netflix in the United States, you still have this kind of rebuilding fandom, the recommendations, the like, oh, well, as soon as it comes onto the streaming service I have, I'm in. You know, people have been telling me I need to watch it. You get a ton of men that are watching with their wives. You get new generations who don't know anything about the books that just go, oh yeah, I've heard about that show. And I think because of that, I think that that means that the market for the book is strong. We didn't make New York Times bestseller with the first one. You pretty much never are going to have that happen with the second one. But what you just want is consistency. And the nice thing that my editor was able to tell me today was that the first week of sales are slightly up from the first week of sales for the first book. So that is the greatest signifier heading into a fourth quarter, which is where there'll be great holiday gifts, exactly, hopefully, with my book. That there's hopefully a good life for it. And that's as positive news as I can get myself, and then just hopefully to share even to the fandom going, hey, we're completists, can we please have a 5 and 6 book, that there's a good sign of it. And again, it's always, and I hate to be a shill, but it's like the people showing up to actually purchase it or buy it as a gift for somebody if they don't want it themselves is always the thing that determines whether Random House would turn around and say, yeah, we're going to do another one of these. And they did it. They showed up for the first one, and I can't thank people enough for that, because that literally has made the book that you have in front of you right now. That's the only reason it exists.
And absolutely, I think releasing the first two seasons on Netflix was a game changer. Because
it really was.
Because, yeah. I mean, I don't know if you followed Twitter, but so many people have been like, I just started watching Outlander and blah, 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 blah. And everyone, yes, was having to tweet their reactions to how amazing the show is and how they couldn't stop watching it. And I guarantee you, every last one of those people signed up for Stars to watch the rest of it because they couldn't wait. So
totally, absolutely.
So releasing it on multiple platforms has done good things for the show, has done great things for actually for Stars and for the books, because we're never going to bring new people in if we don't make it available to more people in new ways. So I can't tout it enough. I'm only one person, and I can only tell so many people in a day that they need to read it, but I keep doing it, and I keep passing out my one copy of a DVD Blu-ray where I'm like, watch this.
Nice.
Give it back when you're done so I can pass it to somebody else. But you I've know,
let
watch
mine,
it.
I've let mine out too as well. And I, you know, have a nice circle of family members and close friends that watch it. So it's really great to, you know, I canvass them as well and just say, well, what did you think of the season? And, you know, and just, I'm like, you're my little case study. So like, ha ha ha, you think I'm just asking it for informational, but I'm actually like jotting these things down for like, you know, the approach of those that just watch the show. And then of course those that, that have read the books. And so I definitely am always, you know, getting what's the lay of the land. But the nicest things, like I was at New York Comic Con and for Sci-Fi Wire, I did the live stage with the cast. And when I mean this, and I with no hyperbole, we literally had basically like a shadow con for all of the main panels that were going on at New York Comic Con. But just, you know, on our little stage with, you know, a much smaller audience. And, you know, 15 minutes at the most for an interview. So if you went to Madison Square Garden, you know, you got the full, oh my God, you know, huge, long experience. And we're probably a lot farther away, but then you got a little micro experience of Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. We were running live stage interviews from 10:30 in the morning until 6:30 p.m. every day. There was no bigger reaction to any of the casts, and we had some major casts than Outlander. Everybody that worked for Sci-Fi went, what the hell just happened when we announced? And the amount of people, it was like Fire Hazard City. It was like all of these bodies like completely squashed in to try to be there for the cast coming out. And it was, everybody looked at me because they obviously know I'm the Outlander person. And just, and I was like, I told you. And it was, and they didn't believe me until they really like heard the bellow of that fandom when that interview went live. It was bonkers. And so it's like when you see that, when a fifth season is starting for a television show, then you go, okay, we're doing all right. That's good.
And we mostly have experience with San Diego Comic-Con, but I can tell you mm-hmm. that any room, because they always book Outlander for like 4 or 5 p.m., but any room that I've been in that has had an Outlander panel, which is mostly Ballroom 20, but
yeah,
almost the entire, I would say front half of that room is Outlander people. And they're there all day.
They have staked it out. Exactly.
To the point that I feel bad for all the preceding panels. We're like, great, cool, psych, not into it. Okay. Awesome. Simpsons. Cool. What's next? Okay, we're doing that. And I mean, we're nice. We're going to clap and be, you know, moderately interested, but you're not our favorite. And you can definitely feel the energy in the room change when it becomes what we're there for.
Yeah. I'm actually kind of shocked because I've done San Diego for 17 straight years. And I'm actually shocked that it wasn't this last year that I feel like it's Hall H level at this point. I just do. I feel like it would fill the heck out of that place. And maybe, you know, who knows where production timing is, but maybe season 6 would end up making it into just in, you know, the timing of when they promote versus when they're shooting and all that kind of good stuff. But whenever they, because obviously 5 will be finished by the time next year's New York, San Diego comes around. But if 6, I would not be shocked, I would say, and again, this is not with anybody telling me anything. It's just when you look at the charting of shows that have earned the spot of being in Hall H, I feel like Outlander's at that place by now.
Totally agree. And to be fair, production has to come back for them to actually be pushed back into Hall H. So
yep.
I'm like, yes, they took this whole last year off and we're like, brr, now what? Actually, the last two years they haven't been there. So the last 2 years they haven't been to San Diego Comic-Con. So, you know, we've been finding other things to go and look at. But I guarantee you with the growth of the show and everything else, and I know lots of people that I ran into when I was down there that were also Outlander people who were doing, you know, filling time with other things or who had lots of other desires and likes. But that absolutely would have been in that Ballroom 20 or Hall H line for the whole day before if they needed to. So
totally.
Completely.
Totally. It'll be interesting to see. I guess we'll cross our fingers for a season 6 in Hall H. That would be fun.
That would be amazing.
That would be good.
Well, before we begin to sign off, is there anything, whether it was in your prep, in your interviews, in your write-ups, in the editorial process, or anything, or your travels, are there any funny stories or any anecdotes that you can, that you are at liberty to share?
Oh gosh, that's a good question. Let's see.
No's an appropriate answer.
Yeah.
I mean, it's less fun, but no's okay too.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, everybody is great. You know, I really relish the opportunities to do the face-to-face interviews, and I get an opportunity to do that a lot with the writers. So I had a great time with Tony Grafia, who's the kind of showrunner EP in the room for the writers when Matt's not there. You know, they do so much of the scripting and breaking of the episode. So it was really lovely to spend time with her again. And you know, Matt and Meryl always make themselves really available to me, even though Matt, like, honestly, I swear to God, he lives off of 2 hours of sleep. And that's being generous. I don't know how that guy is not like a walking germ in terms of like just everything's shutting down on him, because he's how do you keep up any kind of immunity with the pace that he keeps? But he wrote a beautiful foreword for the book, and I'm just really pleased for him. He really comes out of the Ron Moore school of all the way back to Star Trek of I'm going to hire really great people and really let them learn on the job, and then I want them to become showrunners. You know, I want them to like take over, and because Ron has always been somebody that has gone in development with the next show or the next idea, and so his approach to making television is I'm not a lifer for any of my shows. It's, you know, there's a natural life cycle to this. And so he really, you know, helped groom and say to Matt, listen, this has been an idea that you've been behind since before, you know, it was a television show. And then, you know, why wouldn't you, with how your hands are on everything, eventually earn the show? And so it's just nice to have watched that process from my perspective, and how generous he's been with that, and how happy, you know, everybody kind of is for him for that. It's you want people to come into their own potential. And I think that's really nice to have seen happen with the show, with me charting kind of the history of it. And, you know, I had a great time with Rick, and that was, like I said, a really long lunch with him. And, you know, he cracks me up, and he's just very fun.
That's the Glaswegian, man. You can't, they're just so like real.
They really are, and they just crack me up. And he's so down to earth, you know. It's just it's like we went and had lunch, and then like he left. He literally ran. He just ran. I was like, "Where's your car?" He's like, "Yeah, I'm staying around here. I'm just gonna go run." Just like, bye. See you in the distance as he runs away. That's not how an interview usually ends. It's like people getting their valet or whatever the heck they're doing, and I'm like, "All right, there he goes, Rick into the distance." So that's a pretty funny story. So, you know, I mean, it's just a pleasure. It's just really fun to be able to to create a relationship with the people on the show so that they trust me and that they feel like I'm not wasting their time, and that at the end of the day, there's going to be something that really, you know, marks for posterity's sake the love and the blood and the sweat and the tears that they all put into making the show the best that it can be. And I don't take that for granted or think of it as a small thing. I'm very honored.
Well, we don't take you for granted, and we're very honored that you have spoken with us again on your second time around with Outlander.
The sequel.
The making of Outlander.
Sequel.
And we're ready
we're ready for the trilogy.
The sequel, exactly. Your sequel, exactly. So we hope that there will be, you know what? I think it's going to happen, but even before then, you know, don't be a stranger. You know,
Thank you. You're
a writer in general.
Yes.
So if you ever would like anything that is, you know, once you join the show, and I hope we told you this last time, once you've been with us on our show, you're part of the community. And obviously, if you have anything Outlander, like, come on, girl.
Thank you.
But if you have anything that you are just, you know, like a different project or something else that you would like to chat about, even if it's not for a full episode, you know, 15, 20 minutes.
Thank you.
You're more than welcome to come on. And we're happy to help promote that.
That's awesome.
I've been silently upset that you didn't come back to talk about Big Trouble in Little China.
Oh my God, I love that you love it. Oh no, anytime you want to talk about that, I would love to, because that was just like, the weirdest, but like one of those things where as a kid I watched that movie and loved it so much and then was like, how did I get here that I got to do this project and that I pitched it and that Paul and I were like, what? They're letting us do this? How? What? It was the project that through the entire time where I'm going, what? How did this happen? So just because, you know, it's a weird movie that like if you know it, you get it, you love it, and then there's a whole contingent of people are like, what are you talking about? I don't even know what that movie is. And you're like, go away from me.
They just don't know yet.
Go away from me.
I promise you, if they don't understand. Watch it, they'll be like, I get it. This is amazing.
It's the greatest. Yeah. It's so great. But guys, if you need me too, please let me know, you know, when season 5 rolls around and if you want to talk season 5 stuff, because I won't be on a book, you know, I'm just going to be doing normal coverage. So I'm working on trying to, and you know, this is, I've said this before, the opportunity to hopefully do what we did with Rick, but it may not be Rick, it might be somebody else, for Sci-Fi Wire, so that we'll be able to do the post-mortem process with, maybe it'll be a rolling kind of different contingent of people. It's always based on when talent's in LA or when they're around, but gratefully, Sony trusts me, and that's a really nice thing, and because of that, yes, I will definitely be able to see episodes early and maybe even a little earlier than others, just so that I can end up being able to do like what we did with Rick. Because when we got Rick, it was literally I did the whole season with him in one sitting, and then off he went. So that was
holy dude.
Yeah, that was for Sci-Fi Wire, and then I interviewed him again for the book. So it was like, hey, remember me? We're just gonna talk longer about it. And so we'll see what ends up happening for season 5. But that's the hope.
If it works out,
I would love to talk about it. Yeah, no, that would be awesome.
Yes, we'd love to have you join us for one of our episode discussions.
That would be really fun.
Or a few.
That would be awesome. That would be really wonderful. I'd love to do that. And so we'll just make a date. Yeah, there you go. So come February or after, we'll chat again, which is awesome. And I can't thank you enough for being so lovely. And, you know, I always appreciate the feedback. So, you know, the feedback that you guys have about the book. And then, of course, if any of your listeners are also like, I wish they had done this or that. I always am just putting those on a little notepad for future editions. So, you know, have a think. It doesn't hurt my feelings. It really lets me try to hone the books into tackling topics that you would really want to know, that you felt like either, oh, I wish that had been expanded, or I wish you really would get this person. And, you know, that just lets me try to make the book that people want. You know, at the end of the day, that's what I want to do. I want the fandom to go, these books feel vital to me, and I really feel like it's giving me the things that if I could ask Tara to put them in there, please do that. And so I do. I welcome that. And if you guys want to find me, if you're listening on Twitter, I'm at Tara D. Bennett. So you can always let me know your thoughts there. And I'm very much about making the books that everybody would like to have. And so I'm open, like Lucy and the Peanuts. My the doctor is in. Give me your suggestions. And that we'll all cross our fingers for a 5 and 6 that I can apply them to that.
Well, something you said at the very top of the interview, and I was like, oh my gosh, I need to point this out, or I need to say this, but it just didn't, it didn't fit in at that point, but now it does especially, is that you were saying that you try your best, you know, especially when you're doing the Sci-Fi Wire or something, you're trying to make sure that when you have an opportunity to interview these people, especially since it's like limited time and you got like, you have an hour or half an hour or whatever, and you're like, I need to get all this stuff done now. You're prepped for that. And part of your prep is not just like, what do I want to know? What do the readers or the watchers want to know? But what have other people said that I don't want to repeat?
Right.
Right.
Yes. Oh, yes.
And that actually is part of the hardest part, because like, where do you there's no way on this earth you can read everything.
Yes. It's hard.
So when you were saying that, I was like, that is exactly what that's how, obviously we're not doing a book, but that's how we feel. We do our best, but we also know that we can't cover everything. And so I think you saying that was kind of like sparked a thought in my mind. And that is, your book is another way. I mean, obviously, but it's such a more rich way. It is another way to relive and enjoy the episodes of the show, because you have the show itself, right?
Yeah.
You have all the fan stuff. You have all the media that surrounds it. You have the official Outlander podcast that Ron et al. Do.
Yeah.
That is like talking about what's going on here and there. Yours is like an expansion upon that, because you get to talk behind the scenes and it's much more pointed. You are not there when this is done,
yeah.
But they're not going to necessarily know what questions we have about what we see, right?
Yeah.
So you're the best of both. You're like a mixture of Ron's and everyone else's people there on the scene, a podcast with all of them or interviewing all of them with the mind and the heart and the inspiration of a true book lover of Diana's.
Well, I'm just gonna float away on that. That's like the nicest thing that you could ever ever tell a writer who sat in her sweats for way too long in chair typing that this book out, hoping to hell that I didn't disappoint all of the fandom. Thank you. No, genuinely, the kindest thing that you can say to me, and I am just floating away on that. So thank you so much.
You didn't create the hashtag Kilt Daddy, but it was close.
No, that's brilliance, and that lives in infamy.
Absolutely.
Forever.
Absolutely.
Okay, so until we chat again,
yes.
And then in the short term, and then in the long term, until we knock on wood, talk again about here's putting out there to the universe for a making of 5 and 6.
Absolutely. Thank you guys so very much. I appreciate
it. Thank you so much.
Have a good night, guys. Thank you.
Thank you. You too. Okay. Be well.
Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.